turned bold and adventurous, and he even more ascetic and emotionally austere. We had become natural opponents. She chuckles and tightens the bandana's knot at the back of her head. And then I took to falling in love, often desperately, and to my father's horror, with the wrong sort. A housekeeper's son once, another time a low-level civil servant who handled some business affairs for my father. Foolhardy, wayward passions, all of them doomed from the start. I arranged clandestine rendezvous and slipped away from home, and of course someone would inform my father that I had been spotted on the streets somewhere. They would tell him that I was covorting. They always put it like that. I was covorting. Or else they would say I was parading myself. My father would have to send a search party to bring me back. He would lock me up for days. He would say from the other side of the door, "You humiliate me. Why do you humiliate me so? What will I do about you?" And sometimes he answered that question with his belt or closed fist. He'd chase me around the room. I suppose he thought he could terrorize me into submission. I wrote a great deal at that time. Long, scandalous poems, dripping with adolescent passion. Rather melodramatic and histrionic as well, I fear. Caged birds and shackled lovers, that sort of thing. I'm not proud of them. I sense that false modesty is not her suit, and therefore can assume only that this is her honest assessment of these early writings. If so, it is a brutally unforgiving one. Her poems from this period are stunning, in fact, even in translation, especially considering her young age when she wrote them. They are moving, rich with imagery, emotion, insight, and telling grace. They speak beautifully of loneliness and uncontainable sorrow. They chronicle her disappointments, the crest and troughs of young love in all its radiance and promises and trappings. And there's often a sense of transcendent claustrophobia, of a shortening horizon, and always a sense of a struggle against the tyranny of circumstance, often depicted as a never-named sinister male figure who looms. A not-so-opaque allusion to her father, one would gather. I tell her all this. And you break in these poems from the rhythm, rhyme, and meter that I understand to be integral to classic Farsi poetry. You make use of free-flowing imagery. You heighten random, mundane details. This was quite groundbreaking, I understand. Would it be fair to say that if you'd been born into a wealthier nation, say Iran, that you would almost certainly be known now as a literary pioneer? She smiles wryly. Imagine. Still, I'm quite struck by what you said earlier, that you weren't proud of those poems. Are you pleased with any of your work? A thorny question, that one. I suppose I would answer in the affirmative, if only I could keep them apart from the creative process itself. You mean separate the end from the means? I see the creative process as a necessarily thievish undertaking. Dig beneath a beautiful piece of writing, Monsieur Boussoulet, and you will find all manner of dishonor. Creating means vandalizing the lives of other people, turning them into unwilling and unwitting participants. You steal their desires, their dreams, pocket their flaws, their suffering. You take what does not belong to you. You do this knowingly. And you were very good at it. I did it not for the sake of some high and lofty notion about art, but because I had no choice. The compulsion was too far powerful. If I did not surrender to it, I would have lost my mind. You ask if I'm proud. I find it hard to flaunt something obtained through what I know to be morally questionable means. I leave the decision to Tout, or not to others. She empties her glass of wine and refills it with what remains in the bottle. What I can tell you, however, is that no one was touting me in Kabul. No one in Kabul considered me a pioneer of anything but bad taste, debauchery, and immoral character. Not least of all, my father. He said my writings were the ramblings of a whore, He used that word precisely. He said I'd damaged his family name beyond repair. He said that I had betrayed him. He kept asking why I found it so hard to be respectable. How did you respond? I told him I did not care for his notion of respectable. I told him I had no desire to slip the leash around my own neck. I suppose that only displeased him more. Naturally, I hesitate to say this next. But I do understand his anger. She cocks an eyebrow. He was a patriarch, was he not? And you were a direct challenge to all he knew, all that he held dear, arguing in a way through both your life and your writing, for new boundaries for women to have a say in their own status, to arrive at legitimate selfhood. You were defying the monopoly that men like him had held for ages. You were saying what could not be said. You were conducting a small one-woman revolution, one could say. And all this time, I thought I was writing about sex. But that's part of it, isn't it? I flip through my notes and mention a few of the overtly erotic poems. Thorns, But for the Waiting, The Pillow. I also confess to her that they are not among my favorites. I remark that they lack nuance and ambiguity. They read as though they have been crafted with the sole aim of shocking and scandalizing. They strike me as polemical, as angry indictment of Afghan gender roles. Well, I was angry. I was angry about the attitude that I had to be protected from sex, that I had to be protected from my own body, because I was a woman. And women, don't you know, are emotionally, morally, and intellectually immature. They lack self-control, you see. They're vulnerable to physical temptation. They're hypersexual beings who must be restrained, lest they jump into bed with every Ahmad and Mahmoud. But forgive me for saying this. You did just that, no? Only as a protest against that very notion. She has a delightful laugh, full of mischief and cunning intelligence. She asks if I want lunch. She says her daughter has recently restocked her refrigerator and proceeds to make what turns out to be an excellent jambon fumé sandwich. She makes only one for herself. She uncorks a new bottle of wine and lights another cigarette. She sits down. Do you agree, for the sake of this chat, that we should remain on good terms, Monsieur Boussoulet? I tell her I do. Then do me two favors. Eat your sandwich and quit looking at my glass. Needless to say, this preemptively quells any impulse I may have had to ask about the drinking. What happened next? I fell ill in 1948, when I was nearly 19. It was serious, and I will leave it at that. My father took me to Delhi for treatment. He stayed with me for 6 weeks, while doctors tended to me. I was told I could have died. Perhaps I should have. Dying can be quite the career move for a young poet. When we returned, I was frail and withdrawn. I couldn't be bothered with writing. I had little interest in food or conversation or entertainment. I was averse to visitors. I just wanted to pull the curtains and sleep all day, every day, which was what I did mostly. Eventually, I got out of bed and slowly resumed my daily routines, by which I mean the strangest essentials a person must tend to in order to remain functional and nominally civil. But I felt diminished, like I had left something vital of myself behind in India. Was your father concerned? Quite the contrary, he was encouraged. He thought that my encounter with mortality had shaken me out of my immaturity and waywardness. He didn't understand that I felt lost. I've read, Monsieur Boussoulet, that if an avalanche buries you and you're lying there underneath all that snow, you can't tell which way is up or down. You want to dig yourself out, but pick the wrong way, and you dig yourself to your own demise. That was how I felt, disoriented, suspended in confusion, stripped of my compass, unspeakably depressed as well. And in that state, you're vulnerable. Which is likely why I said yes the following year in 1949, when Soleiman Vahdati asked my father for my hand. You were 20. He was not. She offers me another sandwich, which I decline, and a cup of coffee, which I accept. As she sets water on boil, she asks if I am married. I tell her I am not, and that I doubt I ever will be. She looks at me over her shoulder, her gaze lingering, and grins. Ah, oh, I can usually tell. Surprised? Maybe it's the concussion. She points to the bandana. This isn't the fashion statement. I slipped and fell a couple of days ago, tore my forehead open. Still, I should have known. About you, I mean. In my experience, few men who understand women as well as you seem to rarely want to have anything to do with them. She gives me the coffee, lights a cigarette, and takes a seat. I have a theory about marriage, Monsieur Beausoleil, and it's that nearly always you will know within 2 weeks if it's going to work. It's astonishing how many people remain shackled for years, decades even, in a protracted and mutual state of self-delusion and false hope, when in fact they had their answer in those first 2 weeks. Me, I didn't even need that long. My husband was a decent man, but he was much too serious, aloof, and uninteresting. Also, he was in love with the chauffeur. Oh, that must have come as a shock. Well, it did thicken the proverbial plot. She smiles a little sadly. I felt sorry for him, mostly. He could not have chosen a worse time or worse place to be born the way he was. He died of a stroke when our daughter was 6. At that point, I could have stayed in Kabul. I had the house and my husband's wealth. There was a gardener and the aforementioned chauffeur. It would have been a comfortable life, but I packed out our bags and moved us, Perry and me, to France. Which, as you indicated earlier, you did for her benefit. Everything I have done, Monsieur Beausoleil, I have done for my daughter. Not that she understands or appreciates the full measure of what I have done for her. She can be breathtakingly thoughtless, my daughter, if she knew the life she would have had to endure, if not for me. Is your daughter a disappointment to you? Monsieur Beausoleil, I've come to believe she's my punishment. One day in 1975, Perry comes home to her new apartment and finds a small package on her bed. It is a year after she fetched her mother from the emergency room and 9 months since she left Julian. Perry is living now with a nursing student named Zahia, a young Algerian woman with curly brown hair and green eyes. She is a competent girl with a cheerful, unfrazzled disposition, and they have lived together easily. Though Zahia is now engaged to her boyfriend, Sammy, and moving in with him at the end of the semester. There is a folded sheet of paper next to the package. This came for you. I am spending the night at Sammy's. See you tomorrow. Je t'embrasse, Zahia. Perry rips the package open. Inside is a magazine, and clipped to it, another note. This one, written in familiar, almost femininely graceful script. This was sent to Nila, and then to the couple who lived in Colette's old apartment, and now it is forwarded to me. You should update your forwarding address. Read this at your own peril. Neither of us fares very well, I am afraid. Julian. Perry drops the journal on the bed and makes herself a spinach salad and some couscous. She changes into pyjamas and eats by the TV. A small black and white rental. Absently, she watches images of airlifted South Vietnamese refugees arriving in Guam. She thinks of Colette, who had protested the American war in Vietnam, in the streets. Colette, who had brought a wreath of dahlias and daisies to Maman's memorial. Who had held and kissed Perry, who had delivered a beautiful recitation of one of Maman's poems at the podium. Julien had not attended the services. He'd called and said, feebly, that he disliked memorials. He found them depressing, Who doesn't? Parry had said. I think it's best I stay clear. Do as you like, Parry had said into the receiver, thinking, but it won't absolve you, not coming, any more than attending will absolve me, of how reckless we were, how thoughtless. My God! Parry had hung up with him, knowing that her fling with Julien had been the final push for Maman. She had hung up knowing that for the rest of her life, it would slam into her at random moments. The guilt, the terrible remorse, catching her off guard, and that she would ache to the bones with it. She would wrestle with this, now and for all days to come. It would be the dripping faucet at the back of her mind. She takes a bath after dinner and reviews some notes for an upcoming exam. She watches some more TV, cleans and dries the dishes, sweeps the kitchen floor, but it's no use. She can't distract herself. The journal sits on the bed. It's calling to her like a low-frequency hum. Afterward, she puts a raincoat over her pajamas and goes for a walk down Boulevard de la Chapelle, a few blocks south of the apartment. The air is chilly, and raindrops slap the pavement and shop windows. But the apartment cannot contain her restlessness right now. She needs the cold, the moist air, the open space. When she was young, Pyrie remembers, she had been all question. Do I have cousins in Kabul, Maman? Do I have aunts and uncles and grandparents? Do I have a grandpère and a grandmaman? How come they never visit? Can we write them a letter? Please, can we visit them? Most of her questions had revolved around her father. What was his favorite color, Maman? Tell me, Maman. Was he a good swimmer? Did he know a lot of jokes? She remembers him chasing her once through a room, rolling her around on a carpet, tickling her soles and belly. She remembers the smell of his lavender soap and the shine of his high forehead, his long fingers, his oval-shaped lapis cufflinks, the crease of his suit pants. She can see the dust motes they had kicked up together off the carpet. What Parry had always wanted from her mother was the glue to bond together her loose, disjointed scraps of memory, to turn them into some sort of cohesive narrative. But Maman never said much. She always withheld details of her life and of their life together in Kabul. She kept Parry at a remove from their shared past, and eventually Parry stopped asking. And now it turns out that Maman had told this magazine writer, this Etienne Boustelet, more about herself and her life than she ever did her own daughter. Or had she? Parry read the piece 3 times back at the apartment, and she doesn't know what to think, what to believe. So much of it rings false. Parts of it read like a parody, a lurid melodrama of shackled beauties and doomed romances and pervasive oppression, all told in such breathless, high-spirited fashion. Parry heads westbound toward Pigalle, walking briskly, hands stuffed into the pockets of her raincoat. The sky is darkening rapidly, and the downpour lashing at her face is becoming heavier and more steady, rippling windows, smearing headlights. Parry has no memory of ever meeting the man, her grandfather. Mama's father has seen only the one photograph of him reading at his desk, but she doubts that he was the mustache-twirling villain Maman has made him out to be. Parry thinks she sees through this story. She has her own ideas. In her version, he is a man rightfully worried over the well-being of a deeply unhappy and self-destructive daughter who cannot help making shambles of her own life. He is a man who suffers humiliations and repeated assaults on his dignity and still stands by his daughter, takes her to India when she is ill, stays with her for 6 weeks. And on that subject, what really was wrong with Maman? What did they do to her in India, Parry wonders, thinking of the vertical pelvic scar. Parry had asked, and Zahio had told her that caesarean incisions were made horizontally. And then what Maman told the interviewer about her husband, Paris's father. Was it slander? Was it true that he'd loved Nabi, the chauffeur? And if it was, why reveal such a thing now, after all this time, if not to confuse, humiliate, and perhaps inflict pain? And if so, on whom? As for herself, Perry is not surprised by the unflattering treatment Maman had reserved for her. Not after Julien, nor is she surprised by Maman's selective sanitized account of her own mothering. Lies? And yet, Maman had been a gifted writer. Perry has read every word Maman had written in French and every poem she had translated from Farsi as well. The power and beauty of her writing was undeniable. But if the account Mama had given of her life in the interview was a lie, then where did all the images of her work come from? Where was the wellspring for words that were honest and lovely and brutal and sad? Was she merely a gifted trickster? A magician with a pen for a wand? Able to move an audience by conjuring emotions she had never known herself? Was that even possible? Perry does not know. She does not know. And that, perhaps, may have been Maman's true intent, to shift the ground beneath Perry's feet, to intentionally unsteady and upend her, to turn her into a stranger to herself, to leave the weight of doubt on her mind, on all Perry thought she knew of her life, to make her feel as lost as if she were wandering through a desert at night, surrounded by darkness and the unknown, the truth elusive, like a single tiny glint of light in the distance, flickering on and off, forever moving, receding. Perhaps, Perry thinks, this is Maman's retribution, not only for Julien, but also for the disappointment that Perry has always been. Perry, who was maybe supposed to bring an end to all the drinking, the men, the years squandered making desperate lunges at happiness. All the dead ends, pursued and abandoned. Each lash of disappointment leaving Maman more damaged, more derailed, and happiness more illusory. What was I, Maman? Perry thinks, what was I supposed to be? Growing in your womb, assuming it was even in your womb that I was conceived. A seed of hope, a ticket purchased to ferry you from the dark, a patch for that hole you carried in your heart. If so, then I wasn't enough. I wasn't nearly enough. I was no balm to your pain, only another dead end, another burden. And you must have seen that early on. You must have realized it. But what could you do? You couldn't go down to the pawn shop and sell me. Perhaps this interview was Maman's last love. Paris steps beneath the awning of a brasserie to take refuge from the rain, a few blocks west of the hospital where Zahia does part of her training. She lights a cigarette. She should call Colette, she thinks. They've spoken only once or twice since the memorial. When they were young, they used to chew mouthfuls of gum until their jaws ached, and they would sit before Maman's dresser mirror and brush each other's hair, pin it up. Paris spots an old woman across the street, wearing a plastic rain bonnet, laboring up the sidewalk, trailed by a small tan terrier. Not for the first time. A little puff break shrank from the collective fog of Paris' memories, and it slowly takes the shape of a dog. Not a little toy like the old woman's, but a big, mean specimen. Furry, 30, with a severed tail and ears. Paris is unsure whether this, in fact, is a memory or the ghost of one or neither. She had asked Maman once if they had ever owned a dog in Kabul, and Maman said, "You know I don't like dogs. They have no self-respect. You kick them, and they still love you. It's depressing." "Something else," Maman said. "I don't see me in you. I don't know who you are. Parry tosses her cigarette. She decides she will call Colette. Make plans to meet somewhere for tea. See how she's doing. Who she's seeing. Go window shopping, like they used to. See if her old friend is still up for that trip to Afghanistan. Parry does meet Colette. They meet at a popular bar with a Moroccan design, violet drapes and orange pillows everywhere. Curly-haired oud player on a small stage. Colette has not arrived alone. She has brought a young man with her. His name is Eric Lacombe. He teaches drama to 7th and 8th graders at a lycée in the 18th. He tells Parry he has met her before, a few years earlier, at a student protest against seal hunting. At first, Parry cannot recall, and then she remembers that he was the one with whom Colette had been so angry over the low turnout. The one whose chest she'd knock out. They sit on the ground, atop fluffy mango-colored cushions, and order drinks. Initially, Parry is under the impression that Colette and Eric are a couple. But Colette keeps praising Eric, and soon Parry understands he has been brought for her benefit. The discomfort that would normally overtake her in a situation like this is mirrored in, and mitigated by Eric's own considerable unease. Parry finds it amusing and even enduring, the way he keeps blushing and shaking his head in apology and embarrassment. Over bread and black olive tapenades, Parry steals glances at him. He could not be called handsome. His hair is long and limp, tied with a rubber band at the base of his neck. He has small hands and pale skin. His nose is too narrow, his forehead too protruding, the chin nearly absent. But he has a bright-eyed grin and a habit of punctuating the end of each sentence with an expectant smile like a happy question mark. And though his face does not enthrall Parry as Julian's had, it is a far kinder face, and as Parry will learn before long, an external ambassador for the attentiveness, the quiet forbearance, and the enduring decency that resides within Eric. They marry on a chilly day in the spring of 1977, a few months after Jimmy Carter is sworn into office. Against his parents' wishes, Eric insists on a small civil ceremony, no one present but the two of them and Colette as witness. He says a formal wedding is an extravagance they cannot afford. His father, who is a wealthy banker, offers to pay. Eric, after all, is their only child. He offers it as a gift. Then as a loan, but Eric declines. And though he never says so, Parry knows it is to save her from the awkwardness of a ceremony at which she would be alone, with no family to sit in the aisles, no one to give her away, no one to shed a happy tear on her behalf. When she tells him of her plans to go to Afghanistan, he understands in a way that Parry believes Julian never would. And also in a way that she had never openly admitted to herself. You think you were adopted, he says. Will you go with me? They decide they will travel that summer, when school is out for Eric and Parry can take a brief hiatus from her PhD work. Eric registers them both for Farsi classes with a tutor he has found through the mother of one of his pupils. Parry often finds him on the couch wearing headphones, cassette player on his chest, his eyes shot in concentration as he mutters heavily accented thank yous and hellos and how are yous in Farsi. A few weeks before summer, just as Eric is looking into airfare and accommodations, Parry discovers she's pregnant. We could still go, Eric says. We should still go. It is Parry who decides against it. It is irresponsible, she says. They are living in a studio with faulty heating, leaky plumbing, no air conditioning, and an assortment of scavenged furniture. This is no place for a baby, she says. Eric takes on a side job teaching piano, which he had briefly entertained pursuing before he had set his sights on theater. And by the time Isabel arrives, sweet light-skinned Isabel, with eyes the color of caramelized sugar, they have moved into a small two-bedroom apartment not far from Jardin de Luxembourg, This with financial assistance from Eric's father, which they accept this time on the condition that it be a loan. Perry takes 3 months off. She spends her days with Isabel. She feels weightless around Isabel. She feels a shining around herself whenever Isabel turns her eyes to her. When Eric comes home from the lycée in the evening, the first thing he does is shed his coat and his briefcase at the door, and then he drops on the couch and extends his arms and wiggles his fingers. "Give her to me, Perry. Give her to me." As he bounces Isabel on his chest, Perry fills him in on all the day's tidbits. How much milk Isabel took, how many naps, what they watched together on television, the enlivening games they played, the new noises she's making. Eric never tires of hearing it. They have postponed going to Afghanistan. The truth is, Perry no longer feels the piercing urge to search for answers and roots, because of Eric and his steadying, comforting companionship, and because of Isabel, who has solidified the ground beneath Perry's feet, parked as it still may be with gaps and blind spots. All the unanswered questions, all the things Maman would not relinquish, they're still there. Perry just doesn't hunger for the answers like she used to. And the old feeling she has always had, that there is an absence in her life of something or someone vital, has dulled. It still comes now and then, sometimes with power that catches her unawares, but less frequently than it used to. Perry has never been this content, has never felt this happily moored. In 1981, when Isabel is 3, Perry, a few months pregnant with Alain, has to go to Munich for a conference. She will present a paper that she has co-authored on the use of modular forms outside of number theory, specifically in topology and theoretical physics. The presentation is received well, and afterward, Perry and a few other academics go out to a noisy bar for beer and pretzels and vice versa. She returns to the hotel room before midnight and goes to bed without changing or washing her face. The phone wakes her up at 2:30 a.m. Eric calling from Paris. "It's Isabel," he says. "She has a fever. Her gums have suddenly swollen and turned red. They bleed profusely at the lightest touch. I can hardly see her teeth, Perry. I don't know what to do. I read somewhere that it could be..." She wants him to stop. She wants to tell him to shut up, that she cannot bear to hear it. But she's too late. She hears the words. "Childhood leukemia? Or maybe he says lymphoma. And what's the difference, anyway?" Perry sits on the edge of the bed, sits there like stone, head throbbing, skin drenched with sweat. She is furious with Eric for planting a thing as horrible as this in her mind in the middle of the night when she's 700 kilometers away and helpless. She's furious with herself for her own stupidity, opening herself up like this, voluntarily, to a lifetime of worry and anguish. It was madness, sheer lunacy, a spectacularly foolish and baseless faith against enormous odds. That a world you do not control will not take from you the one thing you cannot bear to lose. Faith that the world will not destroy you. "I don't have the heart for this." She actually says this under her breath. "I don't have the heart for this." At that moment, she cannot think of a more reckless, irrational thing than choosing to become a parent. And part of her, "God help me," she thinks. "God forgive me for it." Part of her is furious with Isabel for doing this to her, for making her suffer like this. "Eric, Eric, écoute-moi. I'm going to call you back. I need to hang up now." She empties her purse on the bed, finds the small maroon notebook where she keeps phone numbers. She places a call to Lyon. Colette lives in Lyon now with her husband Didier, where she has started a small travel agency. Didier is studying to be a doctor. It's Didier who answers the phone. "You do know I am studying psychiatry, Perry, don't you?" he says. I know, I just thought..." He asks some questions. Has Isabel had any weight loss, night sweats, unusual bruises, fatigue, chronic fevers? In the end, he says Eric should take her to a doctor in the morning. But If he recalls correctly from his general training back in medical school, it sounds to him like acute gingival stomatitis. Perry clutches the receiver so hard, her wrist aches. Please, she says patiently. Didier? Oh, sorry. What I mean is, it sounds like the first manifestation of a cold sore. A cold sore. Then he adds the happiest word Perry has ever heard in her life. I think she's going to be fine. Perry has met Didier only twice. Once before, and once after his wedding to Colette. But at that instant, she loves him truly. She tells him so, weeping into the phone. She tells him she loves him several times. And he laughs and wishes her a good night. Perry calls Eric, who will take Isabel in the morning to see Dr. Perrin. Afterward, her ears ringing. Perry lies in bed, looking at the street light streaming in through the dull green wooden shutters. She thinks of the time she had to be hospitalized with pneumonia when she was 8. Maman refusing to go home, insisting on sleeping in the chair next to her bed. And she feels a new, unexpected, belated kinship with her mother. She has missed her many times over the last few years. At her wedding, of course, at Isabel's birth, and at myriad random moments, but never more so than on this terrible and wondrous night in this hotel room in Munich. Back in Paris the next day, she tells Eric they shouldn't have any more children after Alain is born. It only raises the odds of heartbreak. In 1985, when Isabel is 7, Alain 4, and little Thierry 2, Perry accepts an offer to teach at a prominent university in Paris. She becomes subject, for a time, to the expected academic jostling and pettiness. Not surprising, given that, at 36, she is the youngest professor in the department and one of only 2 women. She weathers it in a way that she imagines Mama never could or would have. She does not flatter or butter up. She refrains from rocking horns or filing complaints. She will always have her skeptics. But by the time the Berlin Wall comes down, so have the walls in her academic life, and she has slowly won over most of her colleagues with her sensible demeanor and disarming sociability. She makes friends in her department, and in others too, attends university events, fundraisers, the occasional cocktail hour, and dinner party. Eric goes with her to these soirees. As an ongoing private joke, he insists on wearing the same wool tie and corduroy blazer with elbow patches. He wanders around the crowded room, tasting hors d'oeuvres, sipping wine, looking jovially bewildered. And occasionally, Perry has to swoop in and steal him away from a group of mathematicians before he opines on 3 manifolds and Diophantine approximations. Inevitably, someone at these parties will ask Perry her views on the developments in Afghanistan. One evening, a slightly tipsy visiting professor named Chatelard asks Perry what she thinks will happen to Afghanistan when the Soviets leave. Will your people find peace, Madame Professor? I wouldn't know, she says. Practically speaking, I'm Afghan only in name. Nomme kan mem, he says. But still, you must have some insight. She smiles, trying to keep at bay the inadequacy that always creeps in with these queries. Just what I read in Le Monde, like you. But you grew up there, no? I left when I was very little. Have you seen my husband? He's the one with the elbow patches. What she says is true. She does follow the news, reads in the papers about the war, the West arming the Mujahideen. But Afghanistan has receded in her mind. She has plenty to keep her busy at home, which is now a pretty 4-bedroom house in Guyenne-Court, about 20 kilometers from the center of Paris. They live on a small hill, near a park with walking trails and ponds. Eric is writing plays now, in addition to teaching. One of his plays, a light-hearted political farce, is going to be produced in the fall at a small theater near Hotel de Ville, in Paris, and he has already been commissioned to write another. Isabel has grown into a quiet but bright and thoughtful adolescent. She keeps a diary and reads a novel a week. She likes Sinead O'Connor. She has long, beautiful fingers and takes cello lessons. In a few weeks, she will perform Tchaikovsky's Chanson Triste at a recital. She was resistant at first to taking up the cello, and Parry has taken a few lessons with her as a show of solidarity. It proved both unnecessary and unfeasible. Unnecessary because Isabel quickly latched onto the instrument of her own accord, and unfeasible because the cello made Parry's hands ache. For a year now, Parry has been waking in the morning with a stiffness in her hands and wrists that won't loosen up for half an hour, sometimes an hour. Eric has quit pressuring her to see a doctor and is now insisting. "You're only 43, Parry," he says. "This is not normal." Parry has set up an appointment. Alain, their middle child, has a sly, roguish charm. He's obsessed with martial arts. He was born prematurely and is still small for a boy of 11. But what he lacks in stature, he more than makes up for with desire and gumption. His opponents are always fooled by his wispy frame and slim legs. They underestimate him. Parry and Eric have often lain in bed at night and marveled at his enormous will and ferocious energy. Parry worries about neither Isabel nor Anna. It is Thierry who concerns her. Thierry, who perhaps, on some dark primordial level, senses that he was unexpected, unintended, uninvited. Thierry is prone to wounding silences and narrow looks, to fussing and fiddling whenever Parry asks something of him. He defies her for no other reason, it seems to Parry, than defiance itself. Some days, a cloud gathers over him. Parry can tell. She can almost see it. It gathers and swells, until at last it splits open, spilling a torrent of cheek-quivering, foot-stomping rage that frightens Parry and leaves Eric to blink and smile miserably. Parry knows, instinctively, that Thierry will be for her, like the ache in her joints, a lifelong worry. She wonders often what sort of grandmother Maman would have made, especially with Thierry. Intuitively, Parry thinks Maman would have proved helpful with him. She might have seen something of herself in him, though not biologically, of course. Parry has been certain of that for some time. The children know of Maman. Isabel, in particular, is curious. She has read many of her poems. "I wish I'd met her," she says. "She sounds glamorous. I think we would have made good friends, she and I. Do you think? We would have read the same books. I would have played cello for her." "Well, she would have loved that," Parry says. "That much I am sure of." Parry has not told the children about the suicide. They may learn one day, probably will, but they wouldn't learn it from her. She will not plant the seed in their mind that a parent is capable of abandoning her children, of saying to them, "You are not enough." For Parry, the children and Eric have always been enough. They always will be. In the summer of 1994, Parry and Eric take the children to Mallorca. It's Colette who, through her now thriving travel agency, organizes the holiday for them. Colette and Didier meet up with them in Mallorca, and they all stay together for 2 weeks in a beachfront rental house. Colette and Didier don't have children, not by some biological misfortune, but because they don't want any. For Parry, the timing is good. Her rheumatoid is well controlled at the time. She takes a weekly dose of methotrexate, which she is tolerating well. Fortunately, she has not had to take any steroids of late and suffer the accompanying insomnia. "Not to speak of the weight gain," she tells Colette. "Knowing I'd have to get into a bathing suit in Spain." She laughs. "Oh, vanity." They spend the days touring the island, driving up the northwest coast by the Serra de Tramontana mountains, stopping to stroll by the olive groves and into the pine forest. They eat porcella and a wonderful sea bass dish called lubina, and an eggplant and zucchini stew called tumbet. Thierry refuses to eat any of it, and at every restaurant, Perry has to ask the chef to make him a plate of a spaghetti with plain tomato sauce. No meat, no cheese. At Isabel's request, she has recently discovered opera. One night they attended production of Giacomo Puccini's Tosca. To survive the ordeal, Colette and Perry surreptitiously pass each other a silver flask of cheap vodka. By the middle of Act Two, they're sloshed and can't help giggling like schoolgirls at the histrionics of the actor playing Scarpia. One day, Perry, Colette, Isabel, and Thierry pack a lunch and go to the beach. Didier, Alain, and Eric had left in the morning for a hike along Solar Bay. On the way to the beach, they visit a shop to buy Isabel a bathing suit that has caught her eye. As they walk into the shop, Perry catches a glimpse of her reflection in the plate glass. Normally, especially of late, when she steps in front of a mirror, an automatic mental process kicks into gear that prepares her to greet her older self. It buffers her, dulls the shock. But in the shop window, she's caught herself off guard, vulnerable to reality, undistorted by self-delusion. She sees a middle-aged woman in a drab floppy blouse and a beach skirt that doesn't conceal quite enough of the saggy folds of skin over her kneecaps. The sun picks out the grey in her hair. And despite the eyeliner and the lipstick that defines her lips, she has a face now that the passerby's gaze will engage and then bounce from, as it would a street sign or a mailbox number. The moment is brief, barely enough for a flutter of the pulse, but long enough for her illusory self to catch up with the reality of the woman gazing back from the shop window. It is a little devastating. This is what aging is, she thinks, as she follows Isabel into the store. These random, unkind moments that catch you when you least expect them. Later, when they return from the beach to the rental house, they find that the men have already returned. Papa's getting old, Alain says. From behind the bar, Eric, who is mixing a carafe of sangria, rolls his eyes and shrugs genially. I thought I'd have to carry you, Papa. Give me 1 year. We'll come back next year, and I'll race you around the island, mon pote. They never do come back to Mallorca. A week after they return to Paris, Eric has a heart attack. It happens while he is at work, speaking to a lighting stagehand. He survives it, but he will suffer 2 more over the course of the next 3 years, the last of which will prove fatal. And so at the age of 48, Perry finds herself like Maman had, a widow. One day, early in the spring of 2010, Perry receives a long-distance phone call. The call is not unexpected. Perry, in fact, has been preparing for it all morning. Prior to the call, Perry makes sure she has the apartment to herself. This means asking Isabel to leave earlier than she customarily does. Isabel and her husband, Albert, live just north of Île Saint-Denis, only a few blocks from Perry's one-bedroom apartment. Isabel comes to see Perry in the morning every other day after she drops off her kids at school. She brings Perry a baguette, some fresh fruit. Perry is not yet bound to the wheelchair, an eventuality for which she has been preparing herself. Though her disease forced her into early retirement the year before, she is still fully capable of going to the market on her own, of taking a daily walk. It's the hands, the ugly twisted hands, that fail her most. Hands that on bad days feel like they have shards of crystal rattling around the joints. Perry wears gloves whenever she's out to keep her hands warm, but mostly because she is ashamed of them. The knobby knuckles, the unsightly fingers with what her doctor calls swan neck deformity, the permanently flexed left pinky. Oh, vanity, she tells Colette. This morning, Isabel has brought her some figs, a few bars of soap, toothpaste, and a Tupperware container full of chestnut soup. Albert is thinking of suggesting it as a new menu entry to the owners of the restaurant where he is the sous chef. As she unloads the bags, Isabel tells Perry of the new assignment she has landed. She writes musical scores for television shows now, commercials, and is hoping to write for film one day soon. She says she will begin scoring a miniseries that is shooting at the moment in Madrid. "Will you be going there?" Perry asks. "To Madrid?" "No, the budget is too small. They won't cover my travel cost." "That's a pity. You could have stayed with Alain." "Oh, can you imagine, Maman? Poor Alain. He hardly has room to stretch his legs." Alain is a financial consultant. He lives in a tiny Madrid apartment with his wife, Anna, and their four children. He regularly emails Perry pictures and short video clips of the children. Perry asks if Isabel has heard from Thierry, and Isabel says she has not. Thierry is in Africa, in the eastern part of Chad, where he works at a camp with refugees from Darfur. Perry knows this because Thierry is in a sporadic touch with Isabel. She is the only one he speaks to. This is how Perry knows the general outlines of her son's life. For instance, that he has spent some time in Vietnam, or that he was married to a Vietnamese woman once, briefly when he was 20. Isabel sets a pot of water onto boil and fetches two cups from the cabinet. "Not this morning, Isabel. Actually, I need to ask you to leave." Isabel gives her a wounded look, and Perry chides herself for not wording it better. Isabel has always had a delicate nature. "What I mean to say is, I'm expecting a call and I need some privacy." "A call? From who?" "I'll tell you later," Perry says. Isabel crosses her arms and grins. "Have you found a lover, Maman?" "A lover? Are you blind? Have you even looked at me recently? There's not a thing wrong with you." "You need to go. I'll explain later. I promise." "D'accord, d'accord." Isabel slings her purse over her shoulder, grabs her coat and keys. "But I'll have you know, I'm duly intrigued." The man who calls at 9:30 a.m. is named Marcos Vavaris. He had contacted Perry through her Facebook account with this message written in English. "Are you the daughter of the poet Nila Bahdati? If so, I would like very much to speak with you about something that will be of interest to you." Perry had searched the web for his name and found that he was a plastic surgeon who worked for a non-profit organization in Kabul. Now, on the phone, he greets her in Farsi and continues to speak in Farsi until Perry has to interrupt him. "Monsieur Vavaris, I'm sorry, but maybe we speak in English?" "Oh, of course, my apologies. I assumed... Although, of course, it does make sense. You left when you were very young, didn't you?" "Yes, that is true. I learned Farsi here myself. I would say I am more or less functional in it. I have lived here since 2002, since shortly after the Taliban left. Quite optimistic days, those. Yes, everybody ready for rebuilding and democracy and the like. Now it is a different story. Naturally, we are preparing for presidential elections. But it is a different story, I'm afraid it is." Perry listens patiently as Marcos Vavaris makes protracted detours into the logistical challenge that are the elections in Afghanistan, which he says Karzai will win, and then onto the Taliban's troubling forays into the north. The increasing Islamist infringement on news media, a side note or two on the overpopulation in Kabul, then on the cost of housing. Lastly, before he circles back and says, "I have lived in this house now for a number of years. I understand you lived in this house too." "I'm sorry?" "This was your parents' house. That is what I am led to believe in any case." "If I can ask, who is telling you this?" "The landlord. His name is Nabi." "It was Nabi, I should say. He is deceased now, sadly, as of recently. Do you remember him?" The name conjures for Perry a handsome young face, sideburns, a wall of full dark hair combed back. "Yes, mostly his name. He was a cook at our house, and a chauffeur as well." "He was both, yes. He had lived here, in this house, since 1947. 63 years. It is a little unbelievable, no? But as I said, he passed on. Last month. I was quite fond of him. Everyone was. I see. Nabi gave me a note, Marcos Vavaris says. I was to read it only after his death. When he died, I had an Afghan colleague translate it into English. This note, it is more than a note, a letter more accurately, and a remarkable one at that. Nabi says some things in it. I searched for you because some of it concerns you, and also because he directly asks in it that I find you and give you this letter. It took some searching, but we were able to locate you. Thanks to the web. He lets out a short laugh. There's a part of Perry that wants to hang up. Intuitively, she does not doubt that whatever revelation this old man, this person from her distant past, has scribbled on paper halfway across the world, is true. She has known for a long time that she was lied to by Maman about her childhood. But even if the ground of her life was broken with a lie, what Perry has since planted in that ground stands as true and sturdy and unshakable as a giant oak. Eric, her children, her grandchildren, her career, Colette. So, what is the use? After all this time, what is the use? Perhaps best to hang up, but she doesn't. Her paws fluttering and her palms sweating. She says, what? What does he say in his note? In this letter? Well, for one thing, he claims he was your uncle. My uncle. Your step-uncle, to be precise. And there is more. He says many other things as well. Monsieur Vavaris, do you have it? This note, this letter, or the translation? Do you have it with you? I do. Maybe you read it for me. Can you read it? You mean now? If you have the time, I can call you to collect the charge. No need, no. But are you sure? Oui, she says into the phone. I am sure, Monsieur Vavaris. He reads it to her. He reads her the whole thing. It takes a while. When he finishes, she thanks him and tells him she will be in touch soon. After she hangs up, she sets the coffee maker to brew a cup and moves to her window. From it, the familiar view presents itself to her. The narrow cobblestone path below. The pharmacy up the block. The fluffer joint at the corner. The brasserie run by the Basque family. Perry's hands shake. A startling thing is happening to her. Something truly remarkable. The picture of it in her mind is of an axe striking soil and suddenly rich black oil bubbling up to the surface. This is what is happening to her. Memories struck upon, rising up from the depths. She gazes out the window in the direction of the brasserie, but what she sees is not the skinny waiter beneath the awning, black apron tied at the waist and shaking a cloth over a table, but a little red wagon with a squeaky wheel bouncing along beneath a sky of unfurling clouds, rolling over ridges and down dried-up gullies, up and down ochre hills that loom and then fall away. She sees tangles of fruit trees standing in groves, the breeze catching their leaves, and rows of grapevines connecting little flat-roofed houses. She sees washing lines and women squatting by a stream, and the creaking ropes of a swing beneath a big tree, and a big dog cowering from the taunts of village boys, and a hawk-nosed man digging a ditch, shirt plastered to his back with sweat, and a veiled woman bent over a cooking fire. But something else too, at the edge of it all, at the rim of her vision, and this is what draws her most, an elusive shadow, a figure, at once soft and hard, the softness of a hand holding hers, the hardness of knees, where she'd once rested her cheek. She searches for his face, but it evades her, slips from her each time she turns to it. Perry feels a hole opening up in her. There has been in her life, all her life, a great absence. Somehow, she's always known. Brother, she says, unaware she's speaking, unaware she's weeping. A verse from a Farsi song suddenly tumbles to her tongue. I know a sad little fairy who was blown away by the wind one night. There is another, perhaps earlier verse. She is sure of